Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
The Alaska Office of Children's Services, OCS, is tasked with protecting children and supporting struggling families. Providing a stable, loving home for children helps improve their chances for success in health, education, social settings, and future employment. But an audit required by a 2018 law aimed at improving OCS outcomes found problems persist. Where has OCS had success, and what else is needed? Advocates on both sides join us today for Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The law that sought to improve services for foster youth was referred to by supporters as Children Deserve a Loving Home Act. And although I know there will be points of disagreement today between our guests about the best path forward, I am confident everyone agrees children deserve a loving home. How a child is raised has profound ripple effects through families and communities, affecting health, education outcomes, crime, the economy, and overall well-being. There's a lot of evidence that points to more productivity and less societal expense when children do well from an early age. OCS is tasked with the enormous responsibility of supporting children when there are problems at home. Sometimes that means children must be removed from their home. Today's discussion is centered around understanding why foster care advocates say OCS isn't meeting the test of these responsibilities to Alaska's children. These allegations resulted in legislation aimed to correct problems and provide more funding to help bring on more staff. The law, HB 151, was passed in 2018. The allegations have also resulted in a federal lawsuit brought on behalf of current and future foster children. To help us better understand the challenges the Office of Children's Services has and the work they're doing to improve outcomes is Kim Swisher. Kim is the Deputy Director for the Office of Children's Services. Also representing the state today is Kate Demarest. Kate is an Assistant Attorney General for Alaska. And Les Guerra is an attorney and a former state representative serving 16 years in the legislature as an Anchorage Democrat for House District 23, now District 20. Mr. Guerra wrote and sponsored the 2018 legislation that sought change at OCS. Amanda Mativier is the executive director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska, an organization that works on behalf of foster children in our state. Amanda also researched and helped write HB 151. Welcome, all of you. Thank you so much for all of you coming together. To me, even though I know that there will be disagreements about the best path forward, it shows a huge commitment to Alaska's children that you all were willing to come in together and talk about this issue. So thank you so much for being here. Okay, after that long introduction, I want to get us started here. Mr. Guerra, if it's okay, I'll refer to you as Les.
Yeah.
Start us off. Talk about what prompted you putting this reform legislation together.
Sure. Amanda and I, during the course of my career in the legislature, tried to make changes to the foster care system. Alaska is not unique. Across the country, foster youth are not big lobbyists, you know, not like oil companies, not like insurance companies. And so in a lot of states, foster care is dealt with as an afterthought. And Alaska was one of those states. So in my belief, I grew up in foster care. Amanda grew up in foster care. We believe that every child deserves the right to opportunity in this world and to succeed in this world. But the numbers for foster youth have not been good. The numbers that go to college, the numbers that graduate from high school, the numbers that end up succeeding in life, not good. And so we've done a lot to try to change that. We've added college scholarship money over the years. We've added vocational education money over the years. We've added mentorship for foster youth over the years. But the biggest changes when I was in the minority, in the legislative minority, and you don't have the ability to pass big bills. When I got in the majority, I said we were going to pass the bill we wanted to all along, and that was to go around the country, look for the best practices that have worked in other states. And we compiled them, we made sure they had worked in other states, and we adopted them. It's the biggest foster care reform in the history of the state of Alaska. It was adopted in 2018. We thought that we had sort of reached the Holy Land. OCS at the time was excited about it, but unfortunately since then, as the audit says, OCS has not implemented it for a number of reasons. There are good and well-meaning people at OCS, but there's also high-level management that's not here that has decided that they should do, in my view, foster care on the cheap. So they have not followed the bill, even the simplest portions of the bill. Simple portions that make it easier for kids to go to vacation. It is almost impossible for a parent to take their kid to Disneyland under OCS's bureaucracy. And we actually passed a provision knowing that to change that even simple thing. And even that, I found out years afterwards, had not been implemented.
Well, we'll dig down into some specifics here in a bit. But Amanda, talk about your work on putting this legislation together and where you went to find models that we're working to build it on.
This came from a sort of culmination of efforts over the years. So I came up as a youth advocate. I spent time in foster care, actually knew Kim as a teen in foster care and aged out of the system, but spent time with my peers, I think stressed out about life and what would happen next. When you leave care, it's daunting. And if you don't have the right supports in place, it can be really hard to navigate the world. Then as an adult and a parent with your own family and have to break the cycle of what you've come from. And so for a lot of us, we went to the legislature, myself and other youth in care, year after year to try to come up with, I guess, Band-Aid fixes over a period of time. And so that came with supports for older youth or resources to try to recruit foster families, let's mention support for higher education funding. And so after years and years, we finally had support in the legislature on all sides, and with the state, OCS walked alongside us on this effort to look across the country and see what worked. We brought in experts. And so the goal was to really safely reduce the need for foster care and enhance existing services for those children that would need it. And so the long-term goal was to ensure that children didn't need to be removed. And if they did, they were going to go with family. They had resources in place for behavioral health supports, and that their experience in the system was temporary, was speedy, and they were either back in with their family of origin or moving into a guardianship or adoption placement. And so in New Jersey, which is the model that we found, they were able to safely reduce the number of children in foster care by 45% over 5 years because they overhired. So if we know this is a system that this is one of the hardest jobs, I think, harder than law enforcement in some circumstances, right? For OCS workers who are first responders to child abuse and neglect and see very difficult things. And so it's going to have a high turnover rate. That comes with the nature of the job. So if you overhire, knowing people are going to leave, right, then you drive down caseloads, and caseworkers have time to respond in a way that's meaningful and to do true social work, right, and show up for families and show up for children who are suffering. And so New Jersey was really sort of the gold standard in that. As we looked across the country, there's other states that are doing good things, but it was most similar to the Alaska model, and a lot of people got on board. And like Les said, we, I think, celebrated in a lot of ways as we sort of walked alongside OCS and the state folks in being able to move that forward.
So before we move to Kim and Kate, for both of you, what are this is a very complex system. What do you see as maybe the three or five core elements that are needed for a functioning foster system?
So you have to reduce caseloads so caseworkers have time to visit families. Right now, OCS, the caseworkers don't visit families. They're supposed to visit once every 30 days. They don't do that. So you don't know if a child is being abused. You don't know if a child is in danger. You don't know what a child needs. You reduce caseloads so that caseworkers have a manageable workload, A, so they can call back foster parents when they have questions, so they can extend help to foster youth who need help. But when the caseloads are too high, and they've historically been about 50 to 100% over what a rational caseload is, caseworkers don't have the time to work with families, don't have the time to work with parents, don't have the time to try and reunite a child with their natural parent if possible, don't have the time to search for good placements. And then foster parents quit because nobody returns their phone calls, which is still happening. We've lost our best foster parents, many of them. We still have some good ones. Then caseworkers quit because they have too much work. You give them twice the amount of work they can handle. They go home stressed. They quit within 6 months. According to this audit, the turnover within a year, 50% of caseworkers quit within their first year.
So lower case loads is a big issue.
Huge issue.
What else?
Training. So New Jersey and the gold standard is 6 weeks of training. OCS was doing 2 weeks of training for new workers. You need how is a new person going to know that if you move a child from one school to another, that you've just set them back 4 months in their education? Most people don't know that. Training will teach you that. How are you supposed to know as somebody coming off the street that if you place a child with an uncle or an aunt or a family member, that is much more successful and helpful for a youth and loving for a youth than moving that child to a strange family they don't know anything about. So kinship placements are crucial to making sure the system works. And so our bill had a lot to do with kinship placements, giving caseworkers the time to do kinship placements. That's not happening. Outside of the Alaska Native community, where they do a very good job of finding relatives, far less than half of youth end up with kinship placements in the non-Alaska Native community. We're very thankful for a lot of the Native entities that are able to find grandparents and uncles and aunts for youth that they know. But outside of that area, we do poorly in terms of kinship placements.
Anything you'd want to add, Amanda, before we move to Kim and Kate?
I agree with a lot of what Les said. I think it comes down to workload. Somebody that can show up to do the job, it becomes dangerous when caseworkers can't get out to see children while either in a foster home every 30 days or to respond to an allegation of child abuse and neglect. And I think that's what it always boils down to when you hear complaints from foster parents or the community or young people in the system. It's someone who can show up to do the job. I think further, it's qualifications of that individual. It's been really hard for OCS to retain staff, but there was an effort to sort of strip away the requirements to what makes a qualified caseworker. And so that came, I think, in 2020. And so you no longer need a degree or experience, right? It's a competency-based hiring effort. And I think that's created a lot of challenges with finding the right people. When I was in foster care, I was fortunate to have a caseworker who was a professionally trained social worker who had the time to show up for me and for my family. And that led to, I think, a lot better outcomes because we had a response from the system. And I've been a foster parent on the other side of it, and I know what it's like to not get a home visit for 7 months or a response when you need a number to be able to bill Medicaid to take a child for a doctor's appointment or someone to sign a slip, right, for something related to a need or school or travel. And so it becomes this sort of constant waiting game of frustration. But a big part of it comes down, again, to workload, right? People who have a manageable workload and can respond and show up for families but are also qualified to do that job. What came with competency-based hiring, I think, has been a challenge that, you know, we have some people who are coming through the door are fresh out of high school and now are holding the authority to make decisions about families. And in some places, it's true. You can make more money delivering packages or making sandwiches than you can being a frontline OCS caseworker. And it's a poor investment, I think, in children.
All right. Thank you for starting us off. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about work to improve services for the Office of Children's Services, the foster care system in our state. In the studio with me today is Kim Swisher. Kim is the Deputy Director for the Office of Children's Services. Kate Demarest is an Assistant Attorney General with the State Law Department. Les Guerra is an attorney and former Anchorage Democrat, state representative, and Amanda Mativier is executive director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska. So, Kim, moving to you now, as deputy director, your thoughts about the core elements that really are needed for a robust foster system?
Well, thank you for having us. I actually don't disagree, really, with anything that Les and Amanda have shared. I do think it's a little more nuanced, though, than some of the splashy headlines have indicated lately. You know, I don't know that any of us, when House Bill 151 was passed, could have predicted a worldwide pandemic. But the pandemic has changed the landscape for the workforce here in Alaska and across the nation. And I'm not sure that we've been able to find the right mix to really offset that. And I know that people say, oh, that's an excuse, the pandemic is over. But our current workforce, the people coming up who might be interested in child welfare, which, by the way, is not a lot of people, to include not a lot of people with professional degrees. Prior to our shift to competency-based hiring, we still struggled to find degreed humans that wanted to work in the field of child welfare. We have other professionals that have a lot of opinions about what we do, and that often dissuades people from wanting to work in our field. And so we have an uphill battle at getting people to be passionate about this topic. But the pandemic also impacted that. We have a lot of people that apply for jobs that want to work directly from home. We are not a job where you can work from home. We are first responders. We are out in the field working with families. We have young people that apply for the job and definitely feel uncomfortable knocking on people's doors and going into people's homes. And that's something that we have to overcome through training and a lot of field-based training. And so I think the message that I hope people know is that OCS isn't just sitting back, not doing anything about the challenges that we face. We are keenly aware of the challenges. We use data to inform decision making. We have lived experience voice at the table. We have a youth advisory board that we work closely with, Amanda's team at FFCA. We have a parent advisory committee. In the last couple of years, we've stood up of biological parents that are informing us about system change. And so we are doing what we can, but we can't manifest a workforce out of the blue. And so it's a challenge. And I do think that that gets kind of shoved off to the side as though it's an excuse, but it is a true reality and a fact. And I will just say one last thing. Our staff, who we listen to, those are also voices of lived experience. Those are the people doing this work. It's easy from the outside to make recommendations, but we need to listen to the voices of the people inside. And our staff do say the compensation for this work does not match the level of work required. So we have reported this to the legislature for many years that the pay is not commensurate with the workload. And so we would love to meet the caseload standards in House Bill 151, that we would love it.
In the audit that that was conducted in 2024 concluded that since the laws passed, OCS hasn't implemented. You've been talking about the difficulty here. Hasn't implemented most of the law's requirements or improved the outcomes.
Yeah.
What's your response to that?
Well, I'm also going to have Kate kind of weigh in on this, but I would say we have implemented it. Have we met the outcomes being asked of us? No, we have not around caseloads. But there are many elements of House Bill 151 that we have implemented, changes to policy, to procedure, to practice. We're not a perfect agency. We're not perfect at everything that is required of us, but we've implemented it. It's just that we are still struggling to meet the expectations that came along with the bill being passed. And a lot of that is due to the fact that we cannot recruit a qualified workforce.
Well, turning to you, Kate, one of the things that we've mentioned a little bit that I want to drill down a little on is that stood out to me in the audit was that people without advanced degrees were eligible to be hired as caseworkers. Someone with a high school diploma, GED, or none could be considered. That did seem somewhat alarming for such sensitive work, but you noted this is not an OCS mandate. Tell us about the shift to competency-based hiring and where that came from.
So as Kim said, the pandemic in Alaska, as well as everywhere across the country, really affected hiring, really in every industry, public, private, everywhere. I think anybody who's out there trying to hire recognizes how much more difficult it has become. And so statewide, coming from the governor's office, competency-based hiring was implemented in order to expand the pool of qualified applicants. And I'll just note, you know, this is not New Jersey. The percentage of people with college educations in a state with less access to college education than in a state like New Jersey, it's a lot less people. But that doesn't mean that we don't have really qualified capable, thoughtful, intelligent, and caring people to do all of these different kinds of jobs. So it was not an OCS effort to implement competency-based hiring. That is a statewide standard that OCS is just a part of.
These workers, caseworkers can remove children from home, a huge responsibility for someone with limited training. Are the new workers, especially without degrees, are they working under more veteran caseworkers with advanced training, or are they sent alone at times?
So one, I think, really important thing to note about House Bill 151 is that the caseload standard that's in there, which is to aim for an average of 13 families per worker, that is the heart of the bill, but it's really only one tiny piece of that bill. And OCS has, I think Kim is not really giving herself enough credit and giving the agency enough credit when she says they've mostly implemented. They have fully implemented that law, 100% of the things that are required by law. And the audit actually doesn't really say that they haven't. What the audit says is that they haven't met the caseload standard. So I think the most important part of that bill is about training. And OCS has done all sorts of work to improve and build on sort of best practices in terms of training. And one part of that is that there is a group of professional mentors for caseworkers who do nothing in their job. Their entire job is to mentor new caseworkers. And there's also graduated caseload. So no one is being given twice as much work as they can handle in the first 6 months. There is a much lower limit on the number of cases that caseworkers can take on, even once they get out of their training. So that has had, I think, a really great impact on caseworkers being qualified to, no one is being sent out alone without appropriate supports.
All right, we're going to go to the phones for just a moment. Linda is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I just wanted to know, is there a place to drop off new clothing for foster youth? Is there a central place?
Well, Kim? I would say that maybe Beacon Hill might be a good place to connect with. They do help us with a lot of those initiatives to get youth clothing. So that might be a good place to start, Linda. Thank you for that question.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. And now let's stay with the phones for just a moment. James is in Seward. Hello, James.
Hello. My experience with foster care goes back to the 1950s when they were called welfare homes. And I first went into that system when I was 4 years old. I was in 14 of them. About every 2 years, the only time I ever saw caseworkers when they came to pick me and my siblings up to be relocated into one more welfare home. The criteria in my memory that always stuck in my mind was when you walk into somebody else's homes, you're like a puppy or a kitten. The first thing they do is they sniff. They sniff everything. Their senses are on full alert. And I remember those welfare homes all had distinct odors that stick in my mind, and they were not friendly. And the thing is that you didn't know what the rules were when you went into another home until you broke that rule. And then all hell came down on your head. So my thoughts on this is that we should have a system like orphanages. And I know orphanages got a bad name and all that, but look what the name is that welfare homes have, foster care has. So the underlying theme of this whole thing is when you go into foster care, you're somebody else's stray dog.
Mm. Well, James, thank you for the call. I'm sorry that you had such a rough experience as such a small child. That's heartbreaking. And glad you're here to articulate your concerns today. We need to take a short break here soon, but I wanted to get back to the competency-based hiring system. less, you don't like competency-based hiring systems being used. What do you object to, and is it a broad objection statewide, or is it mainly just OCS?
Well, let's just not use that term competency-based. It means you have no experience in foster care. It means you have no degree. It means you have no training. The definition of what it takes to become a caseworker now has been reduced. They did this in 2020. It used to be you had to be a social worker and have a social work degree or the equivalent in work experience. Nobody discriminated against you if you were experienced and didn't have a social work degree. That was the standard. But OCS wanted to insist on paying these workers $26 an hour. And after the pandemic, that's right, you could not get workers at $26 an hour.
But so OCS set the wage, or
does
the legislature?
OCS does. OCS sets the wage. OCS has never come to the legislature and said, here's a proposal to pay workers $40 an hour. They've never come to the legislature to say that because they'd have to get the approval of the governor, and they've never gotten the approval of the governor to do that. OCS can't do something in violation of the governor's wishes. But competency-based is it's a name that's terrible. It means you have no experience, no degree. You could be 19 years old or 21 years old, having worked in tourism, or never had a full-time job. And we know cases of workers who've never had a full-time job. This is their first job. That is not the way to treat foster youth. OCS did this not because they couldn't find qualified workers, but it's because they wanted to pay $26 an hour and wanted to do foster care on the cheap. So in order to get competent workers, you can. And the bill would have allowed you to advertise for the best workers, because we would have said, we're going to limit your caseloads, come work here. We're going to have the model foster care system in the country. Come work here. That would have been great, but we didn't want to pay for it. $26 an hour.
All right, Kim, before we take a break, what is the reality of what OCS has gone to the governor or the legislature asking for when it comes to wages and salaries for caseworkers?
Yeah, we actually have done a lot. We've asked for several things, and the governor has been supportive of us with the People's First Initiative. He did provide us with additional funding to fund things like, you know, bonuses and additional money for training. And I think it's really important when statements like this get made, it really makes it very difficult, Les, to kind of combat that. You have a very strong opinion, but one single person at OCS down and said, we're going to limit salary to $26 an
hour. That's what you pay.
It's just not the reality. It's much more nuanced than that.
What is the average wage?
Well, it does start at $26 an hour. Beginning social workers, and what we've done is we've created a third tier of advanced caseworkers, and it pays much more than that. I don't have that off the top of my head, but you have three levels: a beginning entry level social worker or caseworker that gets trained. We have a proficient one, and then we have an advanced one. And we have a promotional pathway for our staff as they develop more skill and competency to be able to promote up that chain. And so I think it's important to know that there is opportunity for people to grow in their positions at OCS.
All right, we need to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the best path forward for helping Alaska's children as we discuss ways to reform services of the Office of Children's Services. Let's Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Amanda, I wanted to get back to the competency-based hiring. You said you think it creates more harm than good. Why is that? What leads you to say that?
I think as sort of what's been mentioned, right, you have folks who don't meet the mark in terms of qualifications, and so if you're afraid to knock on the door, what does that look like when you show up to respond to an allegation of child abuse and neglect and do an investigation? Or if you don't have a sense of trauma, right, or systems or substance use or a lot of the challenges that folks in families involved in OCS might be facing, you know, what does that do to the family on the receiving side of that door? Mm. I wanted to also highlight, I think it was said that the current competency-based hiring is under the governor's current executive order. OCS moved to competency-based hiring before the existing executive order was fanned out to all departments. And so I know as a state we're challenged with hiring across departments, but we have to put our largest investment in systems that are meant to protect children, right? I think that certainly we have challenges with infrastructure for, right, roads or, other areas of where our state might struggle. But we have to invest in children. If we know that we're not going to get the right people for a lower wage, then increase the wage. And so if it's the legislature, if it's OCS, if it's the overarching department, or maybe it's union negotiations, right? Someone just has to take accountability and fix it so we can get the right people in the door. I'm a professionally trained social worker. I know Kim's a professionally trained social worker. And what you get with that is you get a foundation rooted in education about how you help people in a way that is ethical, and you show up and you treat people with dignity and respect during some of the hardest times in their lives. But you also learn how to take care of yourself and metabolize that stress. And so when you hire people who are qualified, that's what you get, right? You get first responders who show up with good bedside manner and know how to support parents, right, who are probably experienced one of the worst times in their life if OCS is showing up to knock on their door, right? And they need someone who's warm and kind on the other side of that, who can also do their job and ethically investigate child abuse and neglect, right? To come to a conclusion that's fair.
Kate, I want to turn to you now. As part of what's happened in looking at problems within OCS, there was a federal lawsuit that was that isn't part of this legislation, but there was a federal lawsuit brought. The attorney that represented the plaintiffs, Marsha Lowry, alleged that OCS doesn't ensure children get monthly visits because caseloads are too high. We've heard some of that from Les and Amanda. The caseloads are too high to properly serve children. What is the state's response to that charge about monthly visits?
So I've had the privilege, really, of getting to know OCS, its data, and its people really deeply over the past year of representing the state in that lawsuit. And what the data shows is that OCS does not have enough caseworkers to make every single visit. And there's other reasons why we miss visits too. There's weather in Alaska, there's dark, there's a lot of places where it's very difficult to get to make those monthly visits. But OCS has really excellent systems in place to make sure that even when children are not being seen for a month or two, and it's almost never, and I'm telling you, but in this data really deeply, almost never more than a month or two in a row that a visit is missed, what caseworkers can do is call the ICWA worker in a village and send that person to go and check on the safety of the child. They can do a FaceTime with the child. What they are instructed to do is to prioritize certain families that have the highest safety risks and make sure that those visits happen every single month. And all of this is in OCS's policy, and it is reflected in the data that really there are no children who are at a safety risk because a caseworker does not see them, because OCS is constantly, in lots of different creative ways, looking out for safety first for children who are in foster care. And they really are succeeding at that, and there was not any evidence to the contrary in that trial.
Amanda said that your own personal experience as a foster parent is that you went 7 months without a caseworker visit. Were there other people that are associated with the foster care system, court-appointed ad litems, guardian ad litems, other court officials or folks that did contact and that you had some sort of a visit or some sort of a check-in monthly?
So my husband and I were foster parents off and on for 15 years, and we ended up adopting our oldest out of the system as well. And so we worked with a lot of caseworkers over a lot of years and a lot of systems folks over a lot of years. But certainly we heard from guardian ad litems or youth attorneys, but their role wasn't rooted in assessing for ensuring children were safe in our home, right? Smells and sounds and food and medical care, they couldn't sign off, right, on a more serious medical procedure. They could certainly come and check in and say hello. But there are different roles for people in the system. And OCS's role is to ensure that children are safe. And certainly, I think partnering with tribes or community agencies is great. It's a good way to fill in the gap, but it doesn't take away the state's responsibility for ensuring that children are safe.
And Kate, turning back to you, the allegation that was that the lack of monthly visits by caseworkers violates the child's constitutional rights. And in an earlier interview, you said the lack of a monthly visit is not a violation of a child's constitutional rights. Talk about how that allegation was framed against the state, and from your perspective, what would that violation look like?
So I think it's really important to recognize the function of a federal law in a federal lawsuit like this. That is a sort of a last backstop to protect federal statutory and constitutional rights of children. What we have going on every day in every case is our state superior court judges looking very closely and exercising continuous oversight of those children's cases. And so if a child is not safe, it is a violation of a child's constitutional rights if they are being foreseeably maltreated in care. And the plaintiffs presented no evidence of a single instance of a child being foreseeably maltreated or even actually maltreated in foster care. Our foster children deserve our very, very best, and there is no doubt that we could do better if we had a fully staffed workforce at OCS. But there's a big difference between hitting the standards that we would all like to see, where children are getting the very, very best, and everyone in this room agrees that that's what we want. There's a big difference between that and the notion that children are not safe. The whole point of OCS is that the children are safer in foster care than they are in their homes, and they shouldn't be in OCS custody unless that is true. And OCS is just absolutely committed to that mission. And
of course it is. But are you saying that there's no evidence that there has been harm to children in foster care?
There was no evidence presented in that trial of maltreatment of a foster child in foster care. No, that is exactly what I'm saying.
Would you like to respond to that?
I can respond to that. We do receive reports of maltreatment in foster homes, and we are obligated to investigate those. And when we investigate, if there is grounds to move that child or put that home on a plan of correction or actually enough evidence to show that their license should be revoked, we do that. And so there are times that children do get harmed in foster care. So I think Kate's got a limited scope here around the lawsuit, but we do have systems in place to investigate that, to get training to the foster parents. It's a training issue, and if it's something that can't be remedied, then we go through the process, and which could end with a revocation of their foster care license.
When you noted that you've worked to improve onboarding new people, paying for people to go get a certificate in child welfare, you've changed supervisor training, but you still have employees, as we've noted, that just say, this isn't for me,
yeah.
I'm overwhelmed, I can't do this.
Yeah, what and some of them hear? Have degrees.
And what do you hear about why, that even with support, people just can't hang in there?
So, you know, this work is really, really challenging. And it does take an individual that has a way of weathering through those challenges. And sometimes you reach a point in your life where this work you can't do this work any longer. I've reached that point twice and come back to OCS after taking a break. So I think it's really important to know that I don't know any system in the nation that reaches caseworker visits 100% of the time, every single month of every single year. I think there's data out there that shows that. I think that there are training programs that work better, and we've really, in the last year especially, we have moved to a transfer of learning model with more field-based training. We've encouraged our classroom trainers to get out in the field to see what it's like. We have improved that onboarding system because we know that people are coming with less experience. Would I love to hire a bunch of people with experience? Absolutely. And when we do have people that come to the table, by the way, with experience or degrees, we can bring them in at that higher level I was telling you about. We have a lower level for entry people with less experience, and we can bring them in at a higher rate or flex them up as we evaluate that they have more experience and competency to do the job.
You don't like the $26 an hour starting wage. Was there guidance in the reform legislation that says here's what the wage should be?
No, we passed the bill in 2018. In 2018, OCS not only the standard for hiring workers was, do you have a social work degree or the equivalent of a social work degree in work experience, right? Are you familiar with the foster care system? That was the standard for hiring. In 2020, OCS did two things. They got rid of the 6 weeks of training that we required, and they turned that into Zoom meetings. And during COVID, you could understand that Zoom meetings instead of training. And then they got rid of the requirement that you have a social work degree or the equivalent in work experience. They did that. You had two choices. One was to make things better by raising the wage so you could attract people who are competent, who have the background and the experience and the education needed to do this job. The other was to say, let's hire people with less experience so we can do it cheaper. And that's what they did. They kept the wage at $26 an hour. During the COVID years, when salary scales were going up, they didn't want to have the salary scale go up. So in order to get people at $26 an hour, they dropped the requirements to be no experience whatsoever in foster care. You don't need that. No college degree. You don't need that. No certificate. You don't need that. No experience whatsoever. You don't need that. So there have been examples of people where this is the first job they've ever had. That person should not decide to take a child out of a home.
We have the problem of providing funding doesn't magically create more people coming to these jobs. And OCS also has a mandate that they can't turn families away if they need help. You provided information noting 80% of workers carry more cases than the bill calls for. But if you can't turn families away, what do you think OCS can and should do in that circumstance?
The bill said lower caseloads. To lower caseloads, that means you hire competent people at the wage that's required to get the competent people. OCS has decided, and I don't think it's Kim's fault, I think it's people above her, they decided to save money by not trying to hire the most competent people, but they wanted to keep the wage down. So to keep the wage down, you couldn't hire competent, trained, experienced people. You hired people who had no experience whatsoever. Somebody coming out of high school with no experience cannot decide whether or not to take a child away from their parents, cannot decide what help a child needs, cannot work with families in a mature way so that your best foster parents don't quit and your best foster parents have quit. I mean, we have children living in OCS offices right now. They're also not finding foster parents.
But again, they can't turn families away. So what should the legislature do in response here to help this overwhelmed system?
OCS and the governor, which they haven't done, and the legislature should come in and say what wage would be required to hire good social workers. And then hire the good social workers. And then the bill created this amazing model to say to people who wanted to become social workers. In other states, there are other states that don't do well also. That's not an excuse. I mean, sometimes OCS says, well, in other states, they don't do well either. That's not your excuse. We would have been able to say, look, we have low caseloads here. We pay you well. Come work in Alaska. This would have worked. This is something they could have gone to the School of Social Work with and told kids in the social work program and in the Masters of Social Work program, come work at the state of Alaska because we're going to limit your caseloads. You'll have a rational job that you'll feel good about to do good work. They decided not to do that because they wanted to stick at the $26 an hour rate, which will not allow you to ever hire somebody with a social work degree.
I see you shaking your head. No, yeah. We do need to take a break, but quickly.
We have paid internships. We do work closely with the social work program. Prior to this bill, we were not getting social workers and degreed people to apply as well. Department of Personnel came to us with this competency-based recommendation because we couldn't fill the position. So yes, it was before the AO, but it was an initiative drawn by the department or the Division of Personnel to encourage us to open the door because we do have people with lived experience without degrees, especially out in rural Alaska who are working as paraprofessionals or without education that have a wealth of experience working with families. And we needed to crack the door open to be able to hire people like that. Have we gone too far? Yeah, maybe. I think so. And we are trying to pull that back. We are working very closely to figure out how we can factor in education and experience and rate that higher in the interview process. I'm working on that myself, so I can say that without a doubt.
All right. We do need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the future of the foster system in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues. Let's go to the phones again. Chris is in Anchorage. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Did you have a question?
More a comment. This is more about interagency state things that might help the upstream process and keep somebody from ever getting into a caseload or foster care. And that's economic things, people getting their food stamps on time, people getting their TANF applications on time. I know that OCS says that they don't penalize people just for poverty, but there's a huge gray area between poverty and neglect. If somebody gets their food stamps 1 month out of 24 and has a TANF application that never gets processed, there's no money, there's no food in the house, and then the caseworker is there properly saying, this child can't be here. So that's my suggestion, that other agencies also support with their timing and their timelines, and perhaps even some fast tracking for families that are in OCS care or at risk of kids leaving their homes.
Well, thank you, Chris, for the call. A really important point that there's a lot of services that help support families and children, and they all need to function well and make sure they're doing what they can to support families. Amanda, your organization has been working to improve conditions for kids and families for more than 20 years. Who is working within your organization, and tell us about the work that you do undertake?
So we're a statewide nonprofit of those of us who have been in foster care, and we have a statewide youth leadership board that works closely with the leadership at the Office of Children's Services and advocates with the legislature and the courts. And so we have young people throughout the state who are experiencing foster care right now or have recently left the system who are making recommendations for changes on all kinds of things. It might be stuff as simple as like making sure young people have a clothing voucher timely, or bigger efforts to reform the system like legislative changes. During the push to actually move this legislation forward, House Bill 151, we had 56 current and former foster youth who worked on this over 2 years, who were very invested in what it meant. And so a big piece of this bill was the staffing issue and training for caseworkers. But there are other parts of it that were really important to young people. Things like having contact information for your brother or your sister if you get separated in foster care, so you can talk on the phone or FaceTime. Communicate, right? That's a huge issue. Things like leaving foster care with your birth certificate and your Social Security card, important documents. And so there were other areas of this bill too that were really important to young people. And that's a big part of what we do, is we bring foster youth to the table to be able to have conversations with leaders in this state to help make a difference.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Kim, it's Kai is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Thanks, guys. Very important program. I'm wondering if you have any experience or thoughts about trying to get some kind of an internship, preceptorship, or residency-type relationship with some of the lower 48 colleges, training programs for social workers and social service. They don't have to be MSW candidates and stuff. I mean, kind of get them, you know, from the tree. They could possibly come up here, get exposed to the field, what it's really like, and to the area. And I know when a lot of military families have come up here, and they stay. So I'm just wondering about that as a conduit, you know, for quality folks.
Kim, yeah. I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, actually, we work closely with a lot of different programs. We provide a stipend for associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees. We work with distance programs. We have a lot of students that live in Alaska, especially like our military population. They're receiving their education from a school outside of Alaska. We work closely with the schools here in Alaska, with the program in Fairbanks and Anchorage. And so we do have that. What I will say is that child welfare isn't a popular practicum choice. And so we do have to work upstream with other professionals working in academia to say, you know what? Well, you should give child welfare a try, because everything that you learn in child welfare is going to apply working in any social service wherever you go. And so it is one of the best training grounds. But I appreciate that suggestion, and we are working with colleges. But that idea of maybe bringing a student up from the lower 48 is a good one. Thank you for that.
Les, you said before you and Amanda collaborated on the reform law, lawmakers said, let's do things that don't cost anything. But that doesn't sound like they're really invested in making sure that children have the support they need. You can't really make reform without investment, can you?
Sure. We did a lot of things that did not cost very much. But no, you have to hire competent workers. You have to pay them. You have to pay somebody the wage that their profession and experience requires. And if you're going to pay them the wage that is below what they require, they're not going to come work for you. So this bill did actually have money attached to it. And I will say, this bill was not just a Democratic bill. This bill passed a 15-5 Republican Senate, where all people, every single senator, stood up one by one to co-sponsor the bill. Right? This was a bipartisan effort. This was not a Democratic bill. It wasn't a Republican bill. It was an everybody bill. So it came with some money in it. OCS, and I don't blame Kim. So there are people above her who make budget decisions. They've decided to cut the training budget. So training, instead of being in person in 6 weeks, is now by Zoom. You can't train people with no experience by Zoom. It should be in-person training. Now, in 2020, with COVID, it had to go to Zoom.
Right.
After COVID was over, it should have gone back to in-person.
Why is it still in Zoom?
So some is in Zoom, and I think that you'll find this across the nation. Blended learning environments. I mean, we have MSW programs, 250 of them across the nation, that are all distance delivered. You have practicum in person, and we do that. We do have on-the-job training. We have transfer learning weeks that are in addition to the 6 weeks of classroom training. The 6 week of training actually happens in regions in person. We fly people into the regional offices. So it's just factually inaccurate. We were fully Zoom for a period of time, and we've been slowly transitioning back. We've also brought a lot of our training back into our organization because we weren't getting it updated as quickly as we needed it to move with the changing work environment and with our workforce. And so we still partner with the university. They do provide our classroom training in Zoom, but we also have in-person, and we have transfer of learning, and we have mentors for the first six months or longer if that person needs it. So we do have a diverse blended learning environment, and I think that gets, you know, misrepresented.
Has the training dropped, though, from 6 weeks to 2 weeks?
No. No, it is 6 weeks plus 2 weeks of transfer of learning on the job. It used to be 2 weeks back before House Bill 151, which, you know, House Bill 151 is a bill that we love. We appreciate it. We're grateful for the extra positions, for the guidance from our lived experience. But it's a misnomer that we've decreased training. It's not true.
Amanda knows this because she's worked in the system, but part of the training is still Zoom meetings. That's not training. And OCS has done this because they've wanted to cut the $1.4 million budget for in-person training down to about $1 million. So in 2018, it was $1.4 million. This year, OCS is presenting a $1 million budget. To save the money, they have to do the training by Zoom.
Why do you think Zoom training is ineffective?
So what the 2025 audit said was the combination of not requiring any experience by workers and moving training to Zoom meetings was woefully insufficient to provide the needed experience that children deserve and families deserve. Woefully insufficient isn't, that might be okay under the federal standard, under their federal lawsuit they had. Woefully insufficient is not what we wanted to do with HB 151. HB 151, we wanted to raise the standard to make sure foster youth had the same opportunities in life that other children have.
Of course.
That's the standard. It's not the federal standard. That's a very low standard. It's the standard that HB 151 adopted. The federal case has nothing to do with whether they're violating state law.
Is the federal case, though, looking at that also, is the training element, is that part of it?
It is a part of it, only in the sense that it is part of the evidence that OCS put on to counter the narrative that children are not being, that OCS is not doing what it should do to protect children and to follow both federal and state law.
All right, we could have gone for 2 hours today, and I'm sure that we will be revisiting this discussion. I want to thank our guests, Kim Swisher, the Deputy Director for the Office of Children's Services, Kate Demarest, the Assistant Attorney General for the State Law Department, Les Guerra, an attorney and former Anchorage Democrat who wrote HB 151, and Amanda Mativier, who is the Executive Director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska and also worked on that bill, that legislation. Thanks to our engineer, Crystal Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, our editor is Annie Feit, and Wesley Early helped us out on the phones today. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.